past the hospital a few blocks from my apartment. She took me to a small building north of campus, which she called a clinic. I tried to feign nonchalance, act as though I'd done this before, but as we crossed the parking lot, I felt as though Mother were watching me. I didn't know what to say to the receptionist. My friend attributed my silence to my throat and explained my symptoms. We were told to wait. Eventually, a nurse led me to a small white room where she weighed me, took my blood pressure, and swabbed my tongue. Sore throats this severe were usually caused by strep bacteria or the monovirus, she said. They would know in a few days. When the results came back, I drove to the clinic alone. A balding, middle-aged doctor gave me the results.
"Congratulations," he said. "You're positive for strep and mono. Only person I've seen in a month to get both."
"Both?" I whispered. "How can I have both?"
"Very, very bad luck," he said. "I can give you penicillin for the strep, but there's not much I can do for the mono. You'll have to wait it out. Still, once we've cleared out the strep, you should feel better."
The doctor asked a nurse to bring some penicillin.
"We should start you on the antibiotics right away," he said.
I held the pills in my palm and was reminded of that afternoon when Charles had given me ibuprofen. I thought of Mother and of the many times she'd told me that antibiotics poison the body, that they cause infertility and birth defects, that the Spirit of the Lord cannot dwell in an unclean vessel, and that no vessel is clean when it forsakes God and relies on man. Or maybe Dad had said that last part. I swallowed the pills. Perhaps it was desperation because I felt so poorly, but I think the reason was more mundane, curiosity. There I was in the heart of the medical establishment, and I wanted to see, at long last, what it was I had always been afraid of. Would my eyes bleed? My tongue fall out? Surely something awful would happen. I needed to know what. I returned to my apartment and called Mother. I thought confessing would alleviate my guilt. I told her I'd seen a doctor and that I had strep and mono. "I'm taking penicillin," I said. "I just wanted you to know." She began talking rapidly, but I didn't hear much of it. I was so tired. When she seemed to be winding down, I said, "I love you," and hung up. 2 days later, a package arrived, express from Idaho. Inside were 6 bottles of tincture, 2 vials of essential oil, and a bag of white clay. I recognized the formulas. The oils and tinctures were to fortify the liver and kidneys, and the clay was a foot soak to draw toxins. There was a note from Mother. "These herbs will flush the antibiotics from your system. Please use them for as long as you insist on taking the drugs. Love you." I leaned back into my pillow and fell asleep almost instantly. But before I did, I laughed out loud. She hadn't sent any remedies for the strep or the mono, only for the penicillin. I awoke the next morning to my phone ringing. It was Audrey. "There's been an accident," she said. Her words transported me to another moment, to the last time I'd answered a phone and heard those words instead of a greeting. I thought of that day and of what Mother had said next. I hoped Audrey was reading from a different script. "It's Dad," she said. "If you hurry, leave right now. You can say goodbye." Chapter 25. The Work of Sulfur. There's a story I was told when I was young, told so many times and from such an early age, I can't remember who told it to me first. It was about Grandpa down the hill and how he got the dent above his right temple. When Grandpa was a younger man, he had spent a hot summer on the mountain, riding the white mare he used for cowboy work. She was a tall horse, calmed with age. To hear Mother tell it, that mare was steady as a rock, and Grandpa didn't pay much attention when he rode her. He'd drop the knotted reins if he felt like it, maybe to pick a burr out of his boot or sweep off his red cap and wipe his face with his shirt sleeve. The mare stood still. But tranquil as she was terrified of snakes. "She must have glimpsed something slithering in the weeds," Mother would say when she told the story, "because she chucked Grandpa clean off." There was an old set of harrows behind him. Grandpa flew into them, and a disc caved in his forehead. What exactly it was that shattered Grandpa's skull changed every time I heard the story. In some tellings, it was harrows, but in others, it was a rock. I suspect nobody knows for sure. There weren't any witnesses. The blow rendered Grandpa unconscious, and he doesn't remember much until Grandma found him on the porch, soaked to his boots in blood. Nobody knows how he came to be on that porch. From the upper pasture to the house is a distance of a mile, rocky terrain with steep, unforgiving hills, which Grandpa could not have managed in his condition. But there he was. Grandma heard a faint scratching at the door, and when she opened it, there was Grandpa, lying in a heap, his brains dripping out of his head. She rushed him to town, and they fitted him with a metal plate. After Grandpa was home and recovering, Grandma went looking for the white mare. She walked all over the mountain, but found her tied to the fence behind the corral, tethered with an intricate knot that nobody used except her father, Lot. Sometimes, when I was at Grandma's eating the forbidden cornflakes and milk, I'd ask Grandpa to tell me how he got off the mountain. He always said he didn't know. Then he'd take a deep breath, long and slow, like he was settling into a mood rather than a story, and he'd tell the whole tale from start to finish. Grandpa was a quiet man, near silent. You could pass a whole afternoon clearing fields with him and never hear 10 words strung together. Just, "Yep," and "Not that one," and "I reckon so." But ask how he got down the mountain that day, and he'd talk for 10 minutes, even though all he remembered was lying in the field, unable to open his eyes, while the hot sun dried the blood on his face.
"But I tell you this," Grandpa would say, taking off his hat and running his fingers over the dent in his skull. "I heard things while I was lying in them weeds. Voices, and they was talking. I recognized one, because it was Grandpa Lot. He was a-telling somebody that Albert's son was in trouble. It was Lot saying that. I know it sure as I know I'm standing here."
Grandpa's eyes would shine a bit. Then he'd say,
"Only thing is, Lot had been dead near 10 years.
This part of the story called for reverence. Mother and Grandma both loved to tell it, but I liked Mother's telling best. Her voice hushed in the right places. "It was angels," she would say, a small tear falling to the corner of her smile. "Your great-grandpa Lot sent them, and they carried Grandpa down the mountain." The dent was unsightly, a 2-inch crater in his forehead. As a child, when I looked at it, sometimes I imagined a tall doctor in a white coat banging on a sheet of metal with a hammer. In my imagination, the doctor used the same corrugated sheets of tin that Dad used to roof hay sheds. But that was only sometimes. Usually, I saw something else. Proof that my ancestors walked that peak, watching and waiting. Angels at their command. I don't know why Dad was alone on the mountain that day. The car crusher was coming. I suppose he wanted to remove that last fuel tank, but I can't imagine what possessed him to light his torch without first draining the fuel. I don't know how far he got, how many of the iron belts he managed to sever before a spark from the torch made it into the tank. But I know Dad was standing next to the car, his body pressed against the frame, when the tank exploded. He was wearing a long-sleeved shirt, leather gloves, and a welding shield. His face and fingers took the brunt of the blast. The heat from the explosion melted through the shield as if it were a plastic spoon. The lower half of his face liquefied. The fire consumed plastic, then skin, then muscle. The same process was repeated with his fingers. The leather gloves were no match for the inferno that passed over and through them. Then, tongues of flame licked across his shoulders and chest. When he crawled from under the flaming vehicle, I imagine he looked more like a corpse than a living man. It is unfathomable to me that he was able to move, let alone drag himself a quarter mile through fields and over ditches. If ever a man needed angels, it was that man. But against all reason, he did it, and, as his father had years before, huddled outside his wife's door, unable to knock. My cousin Kylie was working for my mother that day, filling vials of essential oil. A few other women worked nearby, weighing dried leaves or straining tinctures. Kylie heard a soft tap on the back door, as if someone was bumping it with their elbow. She opened it, but has no memory of what was on the other side. "I've blocked it out," she would later tell me. "I can't remember what I saw. I only remember what I thought, which was, he has no skin." My father was carried to the couch. Rescue Remedy, the homeopathic for shock, was poured into the lipless cavity that had been his mouth. They gave him lobelia and skullcap for the pain, the same mixture Mother had given Luke years before. Dad choked on the medicine. He couldn't swallow. He'd inhaled the fiery blast, and his insides were charred. Mother tried to take him to the hospital, but between rasping breaths, he whispered that he'd rather die than see a doctor. The authority of the man was such that she gave way. The dead skin was gently cut away, and he was slathered in salve, the same salve Mother had used on Luke's leg years before, from his waist to the tip of his head, then bandaged. Mother gave him ice cubes to suck on, hoping to hydrate him, but the inside of his mouth and throat were so badly burned they absorbed no liquid, and without lips or muscles, he couldn't hold the ice in his mouth. It would slide down his throat and choke him. They nearly lost him many times that first night. His breathing would slow, then stop, and my mother, and the heavenly host of women who worked for her, would fly about, adjusting chakras and tapping pressure points, anything to coax his brittle lungs to resume their rattle. That morning was when Audrey called me. It is possible that my timeline is off here by 1 or 2 days. According to some who were there, although my father was horribly burned, he did not seem in any real danger until the 3rd day, when the scabbing began, making it difficult to breathe. Dehydration compounded the situation. In this account, it was then that they feared for his life, and that is when my sister called me. Only I misunderstood and assumed that the explosion had happened the day before. His heart had stopped twice during the night, she told me. It would probably be his heart that killed him, assuming his lungs didn't give out first. Either way, Audrey was sure he'd be dead by midday. I called Nick. I told him I had to go to Idaho for a few days, for a family thing, nothing serious. He knew I wasn't telling him something. I could hear the hurt in his voice that I wouldn't confide in him, but I put him out of my mind the moment I hung up the phone. I stood, keys in hand, hand on the doorknob, and hesitated. The strep. What if I gave it to Dad? I had been taking the penicillin for nearly 3 days. The doctor had said that after 24 hours I would no longer be contagious, but then he was a doctor, and I didn't trust him. I waited a day. I took several times the prescribed dose of penicillin, then called Mother and asked what I should do. "You should come home," she said, and her voice broke. "I don't think the strep will matter tomorrow." I don't recall the scenery from the drive. My eyes barely registered the patchwork of corn and potato fields or the dark hills covered in pine. Instead, I saw my father, the way he'd looked the last time I'd seen him, that twisted expression. I remembered the searing pitch of my voice as I'd screamed at him. Like Kylie, I don't remember what I saw when I first looked at my father. I know that when Mother had removed the gauze that morning, she'd found that his ears were so burned, the skin so glutinous, they had fused the syrupy tissue behind them. When I walked through the back door, the first thing I saw was Mother grasping a butter knife, which she was using to pry my father's ears from his skull. I can still picture her gripping the knife, her eyes fixed, focused, but where my father should be, there's an aperture in my memory. The smell in the room was powerful, of charred flesh and of comfrey, mullein, and plantain. I watched Mother and Audrey change his remaining bandages. They began with his hands. His fingers were slimy, coated in a pale ooze that was either melted skin or pus. His arms were not burned, and neither were his shoulders or back, but a thick swath of gauze ran over his stomach and chest. When they removed it, I was pleased to see large patches of raw, angry skin. There were a few craters from where the flames must have concentrated in jets. They gave off a pungent smell, like meat gone to rot, and were filled with white pools. But it was his face that visited my dreams that night. He still had a forehead and nose. The skin around his eyes and partway down his cheeks was pink and healthy. But below his nose, nothing was where it should be. Red, mangled, sagging, it looked like a plastic drama mask that had been held too close to a candle. Dad hadn't swallowed anything, no food, no water, for nearly 3 days. Mother called a hospital in Utah and begged them to give her an IV. "I need to hydrate him," she said. "He'll die if he doesn't get water." The doctor said he would send a chopper that very minute, but Mother said no. "Then I can't help you," the doctor said. "You're going to kill him, and I want no part of it." Mother was beside herself. In a final, desperate act, she gave Dad an enema, pushing the tube in as far as she dared, trying to flush enough liquid through his rectum to keep him alive. She had no idea if it would work, if there was even an organ in that part of the body to absorb the water, but it was the only orifice that hadn't been scorched. I slept on the living room floor that night, so I could be there, in the room, when we lost him. I awoke several times to gasps and flights of movements and murmurs that it had happened again. He'd stopped breathing. Once, an hour before dawn, his breath left him, and I was sure it was the end. He was dead and would not be raised. I rested my hand on a small patch of bandages while Audrey and Mother rushed around me, chanting and tapping. The room was not at peace, or maybe it's just that I wasn't. For years, my father and I had been locked in conflict, an endless battle of wills. I thought I had accepted it, accepted our relationship for what it was. But in that moment, I realized how much I'd been counting on that conflict coming to an end, how deeply I believed in a future in which we would be a father and daughter at peace. I watched his chest, prayed for him to breathe, but he didn't. Then too much time had passed. I was preparing to move away, to let my mother and sister say goodbye, when he coughed, a brittle, rasping hack that sounded like crepe paper being crinkled. Then, like Lazarus reanimated, his chest began to rise and fall. I told Mother I was leaving. "Dad might survive," I said, "and if he does, strep can't be what kills him." Mother's business came to a halt. The women who worked for her stopped concocting tinctures and bottling oils and instead made vats of salve, a new recipe of comfrey, lobelia, and plantain that Mother had concocted specifically for my father. Mother smeared the salve over Dad's upper body twice a day. I don't remember what other treatments they used, and I don't know enough about the energy work to give an account. I know they went through 17 gallons of salve in the first 2 weeks, and that Mother was ordering gauze in bulk. Tyler flew in from Purdue. He took over for Mother, changing the bandages on Dad's fingers every morning, scraping away the layers of skin and muscle that had necrotized during the night. It didn't hurt. The nerves were dead. "I scraped off so many layers," Tyler told me. "I was sure that one morning I'd hit bone." Dad's fingers began to bow, bending unnaturally backward at the joint. This was because the tendons had begun to shrivel and contract. Tyler tried to curl Dad's fingers to elongate the tendons and prevent the deformity from becoming permanent, but Dad couldn't bear the pain. I came back to Buck's Peak when I was sure the strep was gone. I sat by Dad's bed, dripping teaspoons of water into his mouth with a medical dropper and feeding him pureed vegetables as if he were a toddler. He rarely spoke. The pain made it difficult for him to focus. He could hardly get through a sentence before his mind surrendered to it. Mother offered to buy him pharmaceuticals, the strongest analgesics she could get her hands on, but he declined them. This was the Lord's pain, he said, and he would feel every part of it. While I was away, I had scoured every video store within 100 miles until I had found the complete box set of The Honeymooners. I held it up for Dad. He blinked to show me he'd seen it. I asked if he wanted to watch an episode. He blinked again. I pushed the first tape into the VCR and sat beside him, searching his warped face, listening to his soft whimpers, while on the screen, Alice Cramden outfoxed her husband again and again. Chapter 26. Waiting for Moving Water. Dad didn't leave his bed for 2 months unless one of my brothers was carrying him. He peed in a bottle, and the enemas continued. Even after it became clear that he would live, we had no idea what kind of life it would be. All we could do was wait, and soon it felt as though everything we did was just another form of waiting. Waiting to feed him, waiting to change his bandages, waiting to see how much of our father would grow back. It was difficult to imagine a man like Dad, proud, strong, physical, permanently impaired. I wondered how he would adjust if Mother were forever cutting his food for him, if he could live a happy life if he wasn't able to grasp a hammer. So much had been lost. But mixed in with the sadness, I also felt hope. Dad had always been a hard man, a man who knew the truth on every subject and wasn't interested in what anybody else had to say. We listened to him, never the other way around. When he was not speaking, he required silence. The explosion transformed him from lecturer to observer. Speaking was difficult for him because of the constant pain, but also because his throat was burned. So he watched. He listened. He lay hour after hour, day after day, his eyes alert, his mouth shut. Within a few weeks, my father, who years earlier had not been able to guess my age within half a decade, knew about my classes, my boyfriend, my summer job. I hadn't told him any of it, but he'd listened to the chatter between me and Audrey as we changed his bandages, and he'd remembered.
"I'd like to hear more about them classes,"
he rasped one morning near the end of the summer.
"It sounds real interesting."
It felt like a new beginning. Dad was still bedridden when Sean and Emily announced their engagement. It was supper time, and the family was gathered around the kitchen table when Sean said he guessed he'd marry Emily after all. There was silence while forks scraped plates. Mother asked if he was serious. He said he wasn't, that he figured he'd find somebody better before he actually had to go through with it. Emily sat next to him, wearing a warped smile. I didn't sleep that night. I kept checking the bolt on the door. The present seemed vulnerable to the past, as if it might be overwhelmed by it, as if I might blink, and when my eyes opened, I would be 15. The next morning, Sean said he and Emily were planning a 20-mile horse ride to Bloomington Lake. I surprised both of us by saying I wanted to go. I felt anxious when I imagined all those hours in the wilderness with Sean, but I pushed the anxiety aside. There was something I had to do. 50 miles feels like 500 on a horse, particularly if your body is more accustomed to a chair than a saddle. When we arrived at the lake, Sean and Emily slipped nimbly off their horses and began to make camp. It was all I could do to unhitch Apollo's saddle and ease myself onto a fallen tree. I watched Emily set up the tent we were to share. She was tall and unthinkably slight, with long, straight hair so blonde it was nearly silver. We built a fire and sang campfire songs. We played cards. Then we went to our tents. I lay awake in the dark next to Emily, listening to the crickets. I was trying to imagine how to begin the conversation, how to tell her she shouldn't marry my brother, when she spoke.
"I want to talk to you about Sean," she said. "I know he's got some problems."
"He does," I said.
"He's a spiritual man," Emily said. "God has given him a special calling, to help people. He told me how he helped Sadie, and how he helped you."
"He didn't help me." I wanted to say more, to explain to Emily what the bishop had explained to me, but they were his words, not mine. I had no words. I had come 50 miles to speak, and was mute.
"The devil tempts him more than other men," Emily said. "Because of his gifts, because he's a threat to Satan. That's why he has problems, because of his righteousness. She sat up. I could see the outline of her long ponytail in the dark. He said he'll hurt me, she said. I know it's because of Satan, but sometimes I'm scared of him. I'm scared of what he'll do.
I told her she shouldn't marry someone who scares her, that no one should, but the words left my lips stillborn. I believed them, but I didn't understand them well enough to make them live. I stared into the darkness, searching it for her face, trying to understand what power my brother had over her. He'd had that power over me, I knew. He had some of it still. I was neither under his spell nor free of it.
He's a spiritual man, she said again.
Then she slipped into her sleeping bag, and I knew the conversation was over. I returned to BYU a few days before the fall semester. I drove directly to Nick's apartment. We'd hardly spoken. Whenever he called, I always seemed to be needed somewhere to change a bandage or make salve. Nick knew my father had been burned, but he didn't know the severity of it. I'd withheld more information than I'd given, never saying that there had been an explosion, or that when I visited my father, it wasn't in a hospital, but in our living room. I hadn't told Nick about his heart stopping. I hadn't described the gnarled hands, or the enemas, or the pounds of liquefied tissue we'd scraped off his body. I knocked, and Nick opened the door. He seemed surprised to see me.
"How's your dad?" he asked after I'd joined him on the sofa.
In retrospect, this was probably the most important moment of our friendship. The moment I could have done one thing, the better thing, and I did something else. It was the first time I'd seen Nick since the explosion. I might have told him everything right then, that my family didn't believe in modern medicine, that we were treating the burn at home with salves and homeopathy, that it had been terrifying, worse than terrifying, that for as long as I lived, I would never forget the smell of charred flesh. I could have told him all that, could have surrendered the weight, let the relationship carry it and grow stronger. Instead, I kept the burden for myself, and my friendship with Nick, already anemic, underfed, and underused, dwindled in obsolescence. I believed I could repair the damage, that now I was back, this would be my life, and it wouldn't matter that Nick understood nothing of Buck's Peak. But the peak refused to give me up. It clung to me. The black craters in my father's chest often materialized on chalkboards, and I saw the sagging cavity of his mouth on the pages of my textbooks. This remembered world was somehow more vivid than the physical world I inhabited, and I phased between them. Nick would take my hand, and for a moment I would be there with him, feeling the surprise of his skin on mine. But when I looked at our joined fingers, something would shift so that the hand was not Nick's. It was bloody and clawed, not a hand at all. When I slept, I gave myself wholly to the peak. I dreamed of Luke, of his eyes rolling back in his head. I dreamed of Dad, of the slow rattle in his lungs. I dreamed of Sean, of the moment my wrist had cracked in the parking lot. I dreamed of myself, limping beside him, laughing that high, horrible cackle. But in my dreams, I had long, silvery hair. The wedding was in September. I arrived at the church full of anxious energy, as though I'd been sent through time from some disastrous future to this moment when my actions still had weight and my thoughts consequences. I didn't know what I'd been sent to do, so I wrung my hands and chewed my cheeks, waiting for the crucial moment. 5 minutes before the ceremony, I vomited in the women's bathroom. When Emily said, "I do," the vitality left me. I again became a spirit and drifted back to BYU. I stared at the Rockies from my bedroom window and was struck by how implausible they seemed, like paintings. A week after the wedding, I broke up with Nick. Callously, I'm ashamed to say. I never told him of my life before. Never sketched for him the world that had invaded and obliterated the one he and I had shared. I could have explained. I could have said, "That place has a hold on me, which I may never break." That would have got to the heart of it. Instead, I sank through time. It was too late to confide in Nick, to take him with me wherever I was going. So, I said goodbye. Chapter 27. If I Were a Woman. I'd come to BYU to study music so that one day I could direct a church choir. But that semester, the fall of my junior year, I didn't enroll in a single music course. I couldn't have explained why I dropped advanced music theory in favor of geography and comparative politics, or gave up sight singing to take History of the Jews, but when I'd seen those courses in the catalog and read their titles aloud, I had felt something infinite, and I wanted a taste of that infinity. For 4 months, I attended lectures on geography and history and politics. I learned about Margaret Thatcher and the 38th parallel and the Cultural Revolution. I learned about parliamentary politics and electoral systems around the world. I learned about the Jewish diaspora and the strange history of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. By the end of the semester, the world felt big, and it was hard to imagine returning to the mountain, to a kitchen, or even to a piano in the room next to the kitchen. This caused a kind of crisis in me. My love of music and my desire to study it had been compatible with my idea of what a woman is. My love of history and politics and world affairs was not. And yet, they called to me. A few days before finals, I sat for an hour with my friend Josh in an empty classroom. He was reviewing his applications for law school. I was choosing my courses for the next semester. If you were a woman, I asked, would you still study law? Josh didn't look up. If I were a woman, he said, I wouldn't want to study it. But you've talked about nothing except law school for as long as I've known you, I said. It's your dream, isn't it?
It is, he admitted. But it wouldn't be if I were a woman. Women are made differently. They don't have this ambition. Their ambition is for children.
He smiled at me, as if I knew what he was talking about. And I did. I smiled, and for a few seconds we were in agreement. Then, but what if you were a woman and somehow you felt exactly as you do now? Josh's eyes fixed on the wall for a moment. He was really thinking about it. Then he said,
I'd know something was wrong with me.
I'd been wondering whether something was wrong with me since the first week of the semester, when I'd attended my first lecture on world affairs. I'd been wondering how I could be a woman and yet be drawn to unwomanly things. I knew someone must have the answer, so I decided to ask one of my professors. I chose the professor of my Jewish history class because he was quiet and soft-spoken. Dr. Carey was a short man with dark eyes and a serious expression. He lectured in a thick wool jacket, even in hot weather. I knocked on his office door quietly, as if I hoped he wouldn't answer, and soon was sitting silently across from him. I didn't know what my question was, and Dr. Carey didn't ask. Instead, he posed general questions about my grades, what courses I was taking. He asked why I'd chosen Jewish history, and without thinking, I blurted that I'd learned of the Holocaust only a few semesters before and wanted to learn the rest of the story.
You learned of the Holocaust when?
He said. At BYU.
They didn't teach about it in your school?
They probably did, I said, only I wasn't there.
Where were you?
I explained as best I could that my parents didn't believe in public education, that they'd kept us home. When I'd finished, he laced his fingers as if he were contemplating a difficult problem.
I think you should stretch yourself. See what happens.
Stretch myself how? He leaned forward suddenly, as if he'd just had an idea.
Have you heard of Cambridge?
I hadn't.
It's a university in England, he said. One of the best in the world. I organize a study abroad program there for students. It's highly competitive and extremely demanding. You might not be accepted, but if you are, it may give you some idea of your abilities.
I walked to my apartment, wondering what to make of the conversation. I'd wanted moral advice, someone to reconcile my calling as a wife and mother with the call I heard of something else. But he'd put that aside. He'd seem to say, first find out what you are capable of, then decide who you are. I applied to the program. Emily was pregnant. The pregnancy was not going well. She'd nearly miscarried in the first trimester, and now that she was approaching 20 weeks, she was beginning to have contractions. Mother, who was the midwife, had given her St. John's wort and other remedies. The contractions lessened, but continued. When I arrived at Buck's Peak for Christmas, I expected to find Emily on bed rest. She wasn't. She was standing at the kitchen counter, straining herbs, along with half a dozen other women. She rarely spoke and smiled even more rarely, just moved about the house carrying vats of cramp bark and motherwort. She was quiet to the point of invisibility, and after a few minutes, I forgot she was there. It had been 6 months since the explosion, and while Dad was back on his feet, it was clear he would never be the man he was. He could scarcely walk across a room without gasping for air, so damaged were his lungs. The skin on his lower face had regrown, but it was thin and waxy, as if someone had taken sandpaper and rubbed it to the point of transparency. His ears were thick with scars. He had thin lips, and his mouth drooped, giving him the haggard appearance of a much older man. But it was his right hand more than his face that drew stares. Each finger was frozen in its own pose, some curled, some bowed, twisting together into a gnarled claw. He could hold a spoon by wedging it between his index finger, which bowed upward, and his ring finger, which curved downward, but he ate with difficulty. Still, I wondered whether skin grafts could have achieved what Mother had with her comfrey and lobelia salve. It was a miracle, everyone said, so that was the new name they gave Mother's recipe. After Dad's burn, it was known as miracle salve. At dinner my first night on the peak, Dad described the explosion as a tender mercy from the Lord.
"It was a blessing," he said, "a miracle. God spared my life and extended to me a great calling to testify of his power, to show people there's another way besides the medical establishment."
I watched as he tried and failed to wedge his knife tightly enough to cut his roast.
"I was never in any danger," he said. "I'll prove it to you. As soon as I can walk across the yard without near passing out, I'll get a torch and cut off another tank."
The next morning, when I came out for breakfast, there was a crowd of women gathered around my father. They listened with hushed voices and glistening eyes as Dad told them of the heavenly visitations he'd received while hovering between life and death. He had been ministered to by angels, he said, like the prophets of old. There was something in the way the women looked at him, something like adoration. I watched the women throughout the morning and became aware of the change my father's miracle had wrought in them. Before, the women who worked for my mother had always approached her casually with matter-of-fact questions about their work. Now their speech was soft, admiring. Dramas broke out between them as they vied for my mother's esteem and for my father's. The change could be summed up simply. Before, they had been employees. Now, they were followers. The story of Dad's burn had become something of a founding myth. It was told over and over, to newcomers but also to the old. In fact, it was rare to spend an afternoon in the house without hearing some kind of recitation of the miracle, and occasionally, these recitations were less than accurate. I heard Mother tell a room of devoted faces that 65% of Dad's upper body had been burned to the third degree. That was not what I remembered. In my memory, the bulk of the damage had been skin deep. His arms, back, and shoulders had hardly been burned at all. It was only his lower face and hands that had been third degree. But I kept this to myself. For the first time, my parents seemed to be of one mind. Mother no longer moderated Dad's statements after he left the room, no longer quietly gave her own opinion. She had been transformed by the miracle, transformed into him. I remembered her as a young midwife, so cautious, so meek about the lives over which she had such power.
There was little of that meekness in her now. The Lord himself guided her hands, and no misfortune would occur except by the will of God. A few weeks after Christmas, the University of Cambridge wrote to Dr. Carey, rejecting my application.
The competition was very steep, Dr. Carey told me when I visited his office.
I thanked him and stood to go.
One moment, he said. Cambridge instructed me to write if I felt there were any gross injustices.
I didn't understand, so he repeated himself.
I could only help one student, he said. They have offered you a place, if you want it.
It seemed impossible that I would really be allowed to go. Then I realized that I would need a passport, and that without a real birth certificate, I was unlikely to get one. Someone like me did not belong at Cambridge. It was as if the universe understood this and was trying to prevent the blasphemy of my going. I applied in person. The clerk laughed out loud at my delayed certificate of birth. 9 years, she said. 9 years is not a delay. Do you have any other documentation?
Yes, I said, but they have different birth dates. Also, one has a different name.
She was still smiling. Different date and different name? No, that's not gonna work. There's no way you're gonna get a passport. I visited the clerk several more times, becoming more and more desperate, until finally a solution was found. My Aunt Debbie visited the courthouse and swore an affidavit that I was who I said I was. I was issued a passport. In February, Emily gave birth. The baby weighed 1 pound, 4 ounces. When Emily had started having contractions at Christmas, Mother had said the pregnancy would unfold according to God's will. His will, it turned out, was that Emily give birth at home at 26 weeks gestation. There was a blizzard that night, one of those mighty mountain storms that clears the roads and closes the towns. Emily was in the advanced stages of labor when Mother realized she needed a hospital. The baby, which they named Peter, appeared a few minutes later, slipping from Emily so easily that Mother said she caught him more than delivered him. He was still and the color of ash. Sean thought he was dead. Then Mother felt a tiny heartbeat, and actually she saw his heart beating through a thin film of skin. My father rushed to the van and began scraping at the snow and ice. Sean carried Emily and laid her on the back seat. Then Mother placed the baby against Emily's chest and covered him, creating a makeshift incubator. Kangaroo care, she called it later. My father drove. The storm raged. In Idaho, we call it a whiteout, when the wind whips the snowfall so violently it bleaches the road, covers it as if with a veil, and you can't see the asphalt or the fields or rivers. You can't see anything except billows of white. Somehow, skidding through snow and sleet, they made it to town, but the hospital there was rural, unequipped to care for such a faint whimper of life. The doctor said they had to get him to McKay-D in Ogden as soon as possible. There was no time. He could not go by chopper because of the blizzard, so the doctors sent him in an ambulance. In fact, they sent 2 ambulances, a second in case the first succumbed to the storm. Many months would pass, and countless surgeries on his heart and lungs would be performed, before Sean and Emily would bring home the little twig of flesh that I was told was my nephew. By then he was out of danger, but the doctors said his lungs might never develop fully. He might always be frail. Dad said God had orchestrated the birth just as he had orchestrated the explosion. Mother echoed him, adding that God had placed a veil over her eyes so she wouldn't stop the contractions.
Peter was supposed to come into the world this way, she said. He is a gift from God, and God gives his gifts in whatever way he chooses.
Chapter 28 Pygmalion. The first time I saw King's College, Cambridge, I didn't think I was dreaming, but only because my imagination had never produced anything so grand. My eyes settled on a clock tower with stone carvings.
I was led to the tower, then we passed through it and into the college. There was a lake of perfectly clipped grass, and across the lake, an ivory-tinted building I vaguely recognized as Greco-Roman. But it was the Gothic chapel, 300 feet long and 100 feet high, a stone mountain that dominated the scene. I was taken past the chapel and into another courtyard, then up a stone staircase. A door was opened, and I was told that this was my room. I was left to make myself comfortable. The kindly man who'd given me this introduction did not realize how impossible it was. Breakfast the next morning was served in a great hall. It was like eating in a church, the ceiling was cavernous, and I felt under scrutiny, as if the hall knew I was there and I shouldn't be. I'd chosen a long table full of other students from BYU. The women were talking about the clothes they had brought. Marianne had gone shopping when she learned she'd been accepted to the program. "You need different pieces for Europe," she said. Heather agreed. Her grandmother had paid for her plane ticket, so she'd spent that money updating her wardrobe. "The way people dress here," she said, "it's more refined. You can't get away with jeans." I thought about rushing to my room to change out of the sweatshirt and Keds I was wearing, but I had nothing to change into. I didn't own anything like what Marianne and Heather wore, bright cardigans accented with delicate scarves. I hadn't bought new clothes for Cambridge, because I'd had to take out a student loan just to pay the fees. Besides, I understood that even if I had Marianne's and Heather's clothes, I wouldn't know how to wear them. Dr. Carey appeared and announced that we'd been invited to take a tour of the chapel. We would even be allowed on the roof. There was a general scramble as we returned our trays and followed Dr. Carey from the hall. I stayed near the back of the group as we made our way across the courtyard. When I stepped inside the chapel, my breath caught in my chest. The room, if such a space can be called a room, was voluminous, as if it could hold the whole of the ocean. We were led through a small wooden door, then up a narrow, spiraling staircase whose stone steps seemed numberless. Finally, the staircase opened onto the roof, which was heavily slanted, an inverted V enclosed by stone parapets. The wind was gusting, rolling clouds across the sky. The view was spectacular, the city miniaturized, utterly dwarfed by the chapel. I forgot myself and climbed the slope, then walked along the ridge, letting the wind take me as I stared out at the expanse of crooked streets and stone courtyards.
"You're not afraid of falling," a voice said.
I turned. It was Dr. Carey. He had followed me, but he seemed unsteady on his feet, nearly pitching with every rush of wind. "We can go down," I said. I ran down the ridge to the flat walkway near the buttress. Again, Dr. Carey followed, but his steps were strange. Rather than walk, facing forward, he rotated his body and moved sideways like a crab. The wind continued its attack. I offered him an arm for the last few steps, so unsteady did he seem, and he took it.
"I meant it as an observation," he said when we'd made it down. "Here you stand, upright, hands in your pockets."
He gestured toward the other students.
"See how they hunch, how they cling to the wall?"
He was right. A few were venturing onto the ridge, but they did so cautiously, taking the same ungainly sidesteps Dr. Carey had, tipping and swaying in the wind. Everyone else was holding tightly to the stone parapet, knees bent, backs arched, as if unsure whether to walk or crawl. I raised my hand and gripped the wall.
"You don't need to do that," he said. "It's not a criticism."
He paused, as if unsure he should say more.
"Everyone has undergone a change," he said. "The other students were relaxed until we came to this height. Now they are uncomfortable, on edge. You seem to have made the opposite journey. This is the first time I've seen you at home in yourself. It's in the way you move. It's as if you've been on this roof all your life."
A gust of wind swept over the parapet, and Dr. Carey teetered, clutching the wall. I stepped up onto the ridge so he could flatten himself against the buttress. He stared at me, waiting for an explanation.
"I've roofed my share of hay sheds," I said finally.
So your legs are stronger? Is that why you can stand in this wind?
I had to think before I could answer. I can stand in this wind because I'm not trying to stand in it, I said. The wind is just wind. You could withstand these gusts on the ground, so you can withstand them in the air. There is no difference, except the difference you make in your head. He stared at me blankly. He hadn't understood. I'm just standing, I said. You are all trying to compensate, to get your bodies lower because the height scares you, but the crouching and the sidestepping are not natural. You've made yourselves vulnerable. If you could just control your panic, this wind would be nothing.
The way it is nothing to you, he said.
I wanted the mind of a scholar, but it seemed that Dr. Carey saw in me the mind of a roofer. The other students belonged in a library. I belonged in a crane. The first week passed in a blur of lectures. In the second week, every student was assigned a supervisor to guide their research. My supervisor, I learned, was the eminent Professor Jonathan Steinberg, a former vice master of a Cambridge college who was much celebrated for his writings on the Holocaust. My first meeting with Professor Steinberg took place a few days later. I waited at the porter's lodge until a thin man appeared and, producing a set of heavy keys, unlocked a wooden door set into the stone. I followed him up a spiral staircase and into the clock tower itself, where there was a well-lit room with simple furnishings, two chairs and a wooden table. I could hear the blood pounding behind my ears as I sat down. Professor Steinberg was in his 70s, but I would not have described him as an old man. He was lithe, and his eyes moved about the room with probing energy. His speech was measured and fluid.
"I am Professor Steinberg," he said. "What would you like to read?"
I mumbled something about historiography. I had decided to study not history, but historians. I suppose my interest came from the sense of groundlessness I'd felt since learning about the Holocaust and the civil rights movement, since realizing that what a person knows about the past is limited, and will always be limited, to what they are told by others. I knew what it was to have a misconception corrected, a misconception of such magnitude that shifting it shifted the world. Now I needed to understand how the great gatekeepers of history had come to terms with their own ignorance and partiality. I thought if I could accept that what they had written was not absolute, but was the result of a biased process of conversation and revision, maybe I could reconcile myself with the fact that the history most people agreed upon was not the history I had been taught. Dad could be wrong, and the great historians Carlyle and Macaulay and Trevelyan could be wrong, but from the ashes of their dispute, I could construct a world to live in. In knowing the ground was not ground at all, I hoped I could stand on it. I doubt I managed to communicate any of this. When I finished talking, Professor Steinberg eyed me for a moment, then said,
"Tell me about your education. Where did you attend school?"
The air was immediately sucked from the room. "I grew up in Idaho," I said.
"And you attended school there?"
It occurs to me in retrospect that someone might have told Professor Steinberg about me, perhaps Dr. Carey, or perhaps he perceived that I was avoiding his question, and that made him curious. Whatever the reason, he wasn't satisfied until I had admitted that I'd never been to school.
"How marvelous," he said, smiling. "It's as if I've stepped into Shaw's Pygmalion."
For 2 months, I had weekly meetings with Professor Steinberg. I was never assigned readings. We read only what I asked to read, whether it was a book or a page. None of my professors at BYU had examined my writing the way Professor Steinberg did. No comma, no period, no adjective or adverb was beneath his interest. He made no distinction between grammar and content, between form and substance. A poorly written sentence was a poorly conceived idea, and in his view, the grammatical logic was as much in need of correction.
"Tell me," he would say, "why have you placed this comma here? What relationship between these phrases are you hoping to establish?"
When I gave my explanation, sometimes he would say,
"Quite right.
and other times he would correct me with lengthy explanations of syntax. After I'd been meeting with Professor Steinberg for a month, I wrote an essay comparing Edmund Burke with Publius, the persona under which James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay had written the Federalist Papers. I barely slept for 2 weeks. Every moment my eyes were open, I was either reading or thinking about those texts. From my father, I had learned that books were to be either adored or exiled. Books that were of God, books written by the Mormon prophets or the founding fathers, were not to be studied so much as cherished, like a thing perfect in itself. I had been taught to read the words of men like Madison as a cast into which I ought to pour the plaster of my own mind to be reshaped according to the contours of their faultless model. I read them to learn what to think, not how to think for myself. Books that were not of God were banished. They were a danger, powerful and irresistible in their cunning. To write my essay, I had to read books differently, without giving myself over to either fear or adoration. Because Burke had defended the British monarchy, Dad would have said he was an agent of tyranny. He wouldn't have wanted the book in the house. There was a thrill in trusting myself to read the words. I felt a similar thrill in reading Madison, Hamilton, and Jay, especially on those occasions when I discarded their conclusions in favor of Burke's, or when it seemed to me that their ideas were not really different in substance, only in form. There were wonderful suppositions embedded in this method of reading, that books are not tricks, and that I was not feeble. I finished the essay and sent it to Professor Steinberg. 2 days later, when I arrived for our next meeting, he was subdued. He peered at me from across the table. I waited for him to say the essay was a disaster, the product of an ignorant mind, that it had overreached, drawn too many conclusions from too little material.
"I have been teaching in Cambridge for 30 years, he said, "and this is one of the best essays I've read."
I was prepared for insults, but not for this. Professor Steinberg must have said more about the essay, but I heard nothing. My mind was consumed with a wrenching need to get out of that room. In that moment, I was no longer in a clock tower in Cambridge. I was 17, in a red Jeep, and a boy I loved had just touched my hand. I bolted. I could tolerate any form of cruelty better than kindness. Praise was a poison to me. I choked on it. I wanted the professor to shout at me, wanted it so deeply I felt dizzy from the deprivation. The ugliness of me had to be given expression. If it was not expressed in his voice, I would need to express it in mine. I don't remember leaving the clock tower or how I passed the afternoon. That evening, there was a black tie dinner. The hall was lit by candlelight, which was beautiful, but it cheered me for another reason. I wasn't wearing formal clothing, just a black shirt and black pants, and I thought people might not notice in the dim lighting. My friend Laura arrived late. She explained that her parents had visited and taken her to France. She had only just returned. She was wearing a dress of rich purple with crisp pleats in the skirt. The hemline bounced several inches above her knee, and for a moment I thought the dress was whorish, until she said her father had bought it for her in Paris. A gift from one's father could not be whorish. A gift from one's father seemed to me the definitive signal that a woman was not a whore. I struggled with this dissonance, a whorish dress gifted to a loved daughter, until the meal had been finished and the plates cleared away. At my next supervision, Professor Steinberg said that when I applied for graduate school, he would make sure I was accepted to whatever institution I chose.
"Have you visited Harvard?" he said. "Or perhaps you prefer Cambridge?"
I imagined myself in Cambridge, a graduate student wearing a long black robe that swished as I strode through ancient corridors. Then I was hunching in a bathroom, my arm behind my back, my head in the toilet. I tried to focus on the student, but I couldn't. I couldn't picture the girl in the whirling black gown without seeing that other girl. Scholar or whore, both couldn't be true. One was a lie. I can't go, I said. I can't pay the fees.
Let me worry about the fees, Professor